Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Protests over the Middle East war grew this week to campuses across the country. Now, school administrators and politicians are struggling to balance the demands of free speech with the security of Jewish students who feel unsafe.
Plus, yesterday, a divided Supreme Court seemed inclined to give former presidents, including Donald Trump, some immunity from prosecution for acts committed while they're in office. But where will justices draw that line? The answer could have huge implications for many years to come. Let's pick up those stories on our Friday Politics Roundtable. Jesse Holland is assistant professor at the School of Media and Public Affairs at George Washington University and guest host of C-SPAN's Washington Journal. And Yasmin Abutaleb is White House reporter for The Washington Post. Welcome to you both. Great to speak with you.
Thank you.
Yasmin, I'm going to start with you. Lay out the stakes of this Supreme Court immunity case involving Donald Trump.
Well, the stakes here are enormous, and the justices really seem to grapple with that in listening to arguments yesterday, because this case will go far beyond former President Trump. They seem to recognize that this will set the precedent for what actions a president is immune from and not immune from for criminal prosecution for decades to come, until basically this is tried again and there might be another ruling. And so I think you could see them grappling with the stakes of that from both the conservative and liberal justices and some of their questioning yesterday. Some of the liberal justices laid out scenarios like, well, would a president be immune if he ordered his political opponent assassinated or ordered in the National Guard for, I don't remember exactly the scenario that was laid out. But basically, the short answer is the stakes here are enormous, because this case seems like it will set the precedent for what a president is and isn't protected from, which is a question that we obviously don't have the answer to right now.
And Jesse, let's take a listen to a little bit of that audio. This is Justice Sotomayor, a liberal, posing this question from yesterday's oral arguments.
If the president decides that his rival is a corrupt person and he orders the military or orders someone to assassinate him, is that within his official acts that for which he can get immunity?
Jesse, you used to cover the Supreme Court. Big picture, do you have a sense where this court might draw a line, what can be prosecuted, what cannot?
Well, just listening to the arguments yesterday, it seems pretty clear that the Supreme Court will not say that a former president has absolute immunity from criminal prosecutions. The question is, like you said, where will they draw the line? How do you tell whether a president is acting in his personal capacity or under his presidential capacity? And I'll be honest with you, I don't think the Supreme Court is going to make that decision. What they are going to do most likely is send it back down to the lower courts and say, let's have a trial. You lower courts, you need to make a decision on where that line is. We'll judge your decision, because of course it'll go back to the Supreme Court, but I don't think we'll see the Supreme Court itself say, here are the lines. They'll say, we want a trier of fact to come up with the lines for a sitting or a former president. Here's what you can and cannot do and face prosecution later.
And Jesse, if they do that, what happens to Jack Smith's January 6th election interference trial against former President Trump? It's already been delayed. What happens?
They're going to have to wait until these decisions work their way through the court. Unfortunately, many people want the Supreme Court to make a quick decision so they can see trials of former President Donald Trump before the election. Unfortunately, it does not look like that's going to happen. The Supreme Court always tries its best to stay out of what it considers politics. So it's not going to make a decision that it thinks will weigh the scale one way toward President Biden or one way toward former President Trump. It's going to ask the courts to be thorough. Unfortunately, that is time consuming. And some people will say that is a victory for former President Trump, who doesn't seem to want these trials to happen before the November elections.
Yasmin, let's talk about the other trial ongoing. Of course, in New York, Donald Trump is on trial for trying to influence the 2016 election by allegedly paying off people who had damaging information about him, including an adult film actress. Heading into court this morning, Trump said he thinks it is going well. For people not following the hour by hour, any early takeaways from this week, you know, for this man who, by the way, happens to be running for president?
I think one of the most striking things that has emerged from this trial so far is the testimony of David Pecker, the publisher of the National Enquirer, because he has laid out in pretty stark detail this so-called catch and kill scheme, you know, just when he was paying for stories that Trump did not want published and then ensuring they didn't get published. He said they only published about half of the stories that they purchased about Trump. And in the testimony just I think yesterday, it seemed to implicate members of the White House who were involved in this scheme. So not only that, the testimony has also just painted a picture of a really chaotic White House that, you know, and it's at many points did not seem to be focused on policy issues or the most pressing issues of the country, but Trump's sort of own personal dilemmas and dramas. So I think for people who are not following, I think it might just be a little bit surprising to understand just how chaotic the White House was at times and the involvement of different White House staffers in trying to kill some of these stories.
Jesse, just briefly, and then we're going to move on to the university protests. What struck you about week one of the Trump trial?
Well, I'm going to say that this is a step-by-step lesson for anyone who follows journalism of the difference between checkbook journalism and journalism. Here at GW, this is why we tell our students we don't pay for stories. Because, and they shouldn't pay, they shouldn't work for any news organization that pays for stories, because you end up with the situation in which you hear David Pecker talking about right now in court. Mm. This is, many people don't understand why people won't pay for stories. If you look at what they're talking about, the National Enquirer, and how what they did and what they paid for and what they did with it after they paid for it, this is why most news organizations would never follow along that path. That is the difference between journalism and tabloid journalism.
You mentioned GW University there in D.C. I want to talk to you about that because that's one of the campuses where there's this standoff between students and administrators over divestment from Israel. We've seen lots of protests across university campuses across the country. What's the scene there now today?
Well, I can tell you that the protests going on at George Washington University are literally going on across the street from the School of Media and Public Affairs. You can probably faintly hear the protesters and the drumming through the phone now. One thing that we've said here at George Washington University is that this is not a protest. This is First Amendment activity. Even though the George Washington is private property, we're a private university and can control its own campus, the president, the deans, and the school have allowed these protests to go forward. Now, what the future will bring, that I don't know. But right now, these protesters are across the street. They're taking advantage of their First Amendment rights. And right now, they're being allowed to do so. But I will say, unfortunately, next week is finals week. So the pressure will go up next week as professors and students have to get through finals and get to graduation. We don't know what the future is going to bring, but right now they're expressing their First Amendment rights across the street from where I am right now.
Yasmin, you're reporting on this and the political implications of these widening protests. Speaking to reporters on Monday, President Biden made his first public comments about the protests. Let's take a listen. It's a little off mic. Here we go.
I condemn the anti-Semitic protests. That's why I've set up a program to deal with that. I also condemn those who don't understand what's going on with the Palestinians.
Meantime, in New York, Donald Trump, there's more sound coming here, blame the unrest on President Biden.
And it's really on Biden. He has the wrong signal. He's got the wrong tone. He's got the wrong words. He doesn't know who he's backing. And it's a mess.
Yeah, and it's a mess. Yeah, that audio is a little off mic too. Yasmin, President Biden, what balance is he trying to strike here politically?
Well, President Biden's handling of this war has really fractured the Democratic coalition and the coalition that he really needs to be able to win this election. So I think you can see in that answer that you played, he on the one hand condemns the anti-Semitism that's arisen at some of these campuses, some of the anti-Semitic chants that have come. I think it's important to note that most of these protests have been peaceful, and in a lot of cases, the student organizers have condemned some of the anti-Semitic statements, chants that have come up, sometimes not from students themselves. And then he also says, which I thought was quite notable, I also condemn those who don't understand what's going on with the Palestinians. And I think that just shows this kind of impossible balance the president needs to strike right now, where he doesn't want to alienate the people who are happy with how he's handled this war, who very much approve of his unconditional support of Israel and believe, you know, that's what he should be doing. But he also has a significant portion of his Democratic coalition, not just Arabs and Muslims, but young voters, and of course the people protesting on these campuses, progressives, people of color, who very much disapprove of his handling of the war, who do not want the U.S. to continue sending military aid to Israel, and who are calling for the universities to divest from any ties from Israel and to back a permanent ceasefire. So you see him trying to sort of not anger anyone because he needs all of these people as part of his coalition.
Yasmin, we have a few seconds left. What are you hearing from the Republican side of the aisle on these protests?
Sure. So President Trump, of course, is using this not only to air his own political grievances, but to attack Biden as, you know, there things being out of control because he can't keep the country under control. And then you've seen a lot of Republicans, Governor Greg Abbott, Brian Kemp, others, you know, using really aggressive tactics to try to disperse protesters, calling in state troopers, a lot of Republicans calling in for protesters to be deported or arrested. So just really aggressive tactics to try to demonstrate law and order.
We're going to head off to the weekend after a busy week. Yasmin Abutaleb, the White House reporter, White House reporter for The Washington Post, and Jesse Holland at George Washington University. Thanks to you both.